Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Turtletaub from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. Joining us today from New York is Dan Shore. Dan is Managing Director at Ankara Consulting. And we're going to be talking today about Title IX. As I think everyone knows, there's been some very significant changes to it. Dan's going to talk us through them. First, Dan, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me on, Adam. It's great to talk with you.
Our pleasure as well. So let's start in. The changes focus on the handling of sexual misconduct allegations, and there are a lot of changes. Let's start with the new definition of sexual harassment. What is it and how is it different from the old definition?
Sure. There are three main prongs to the new definition from the Office of Civil Rights. The first prong is a quid pro quo harassment by a school's employee. So if someone is required to do something sexual in return for either employment or some other benefit that the person is looking for, that is obviously sexual harassment. The second type that is defined, which is probably the biggest change from the past, is conduct that's unwelcome, that a reasonable person would find so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive that it denies equal educational access. And the big difference there is prior definitions often had severe or pervasive, and now it's severe and pervasive. So that what that means is if one person makes one very offensive act, that can sometimes be not seen as pervasive because it's only one time, even if it's severe. And in the past, severe or pervasive was often enough to be sexual harassment. Now it says severe and pervasive. So many people see that as lowering the bar and making certain behavior not part of the sexual harassment definition. The third part of the sexual harassment definition is anything that's sexual assault, dating violence, domestic violence, stalking, and the definitions for those come from the Clery Act and the Violence Against Women Act.
Now, how universities need to change the way they treat the accused to comply with the new rules? Because I understand there's been quite a bit of difference in the approach there.
There are a lot of protections for due process for the person who's called the respondent or the accused here. First of all, there's a presumption of innocence that is put in formally into the new regulations. The respondent must receive written notice of the specifics of an accusation. They have the opportunity to select an advisor. There's evidence, any evidence related to the investigation must be sent to the respondent and also the complainant to review. And that is something that wasn't always done by all schools in the past. And maybe the biggest difference is there's a new requirement for live hearings with actual cross-examination of witnesses in higher education. So if someone is a respondent in a Title IX accusation, that student would actually be able to have an advisor cross-examine the complainant and other witnesses in a live hearing, although the regulations say the cross-examination can't be done by the party him or herself. So in other words, if someone's accused of a sexual assault, they don't want the situation of the person who might have committed the sexual assault then questioning the complainant. But there'll still be an advisor who can ask questions, and that is a major change. Although they also say that the cross-examination could be done remotely in different rooms so the people aren't facing each other. But that's a major change. And there are rape shield protections for the complainant. So the complainant can't be asked about prior sexual history for the most part. So the live hearings with cross-examination, on the one side, they will give more protection for respondents. On the other side, there will be complainants who are going to be much more reluctant to bring forward claims of sexual assault because of the idea that they will have to face the respondent at a live hearing and be face cross-examination. So there's a concern that people will not report sexual misconduct, and that is a possible problem, although it will give more protections to the respondent and more due process.
So we've already addressed a little bit the topic of what's going to happen from the complainant. We talked first about the person who's accused. Now, from the complainant's perspective, obviously, as you said, there may be things that are going to affect whether or not they're willing to come forward. Are there processes that need to change when it comes to dealing with people who are making these accusations?
There are changes, and first of all, they mandate in the regulations that certain services have to be given to complainants, although that was being done before. There an advisor will be given to the complainant as before. There's a limit on the jurisdiction for Title IX complaints, that a Title IX complaint must be based on behavior that occurs in the United States, through school programs and activities. So a study abroad program, sexual assault, would not fall under Title IX here, and that may change what a school might have investigated before versus now. And also off-campus alleged sexual assaults also may not fall under Title IX under the new definition. So that changes what complaints can fall under Title IX. It's also harder to proceed without a complainant's cooperation in an investigation. Sometimes, especially when there's intimate partner violence, a complainant is reluctant to bring a claim, but the school sees that there is a real threat to either that complainant or other people on campus, and they'll proceed with an investigation and a resolution anyway. But here, if the complainant doesn't testify at a hearing, their statement to investigators can't be used. So those are some major changes. And one thing I would note is what falls under Title IX here is really a floor to what the school has to investigate. The school can have a different misconduct policy that applies to study abroad programs, applies to off-campus behavior, and they may have to do that to comply with state law or civil law. So it doesn't mean that schools won't investigate these, but they're not required to under Title IX.
Interesting. Now, what burden of proof for sexual misconduct investigations is being set forth? Is it the preponderance of evidence, clear and convincing? Has that changed as well?
The new regulations give schools the option of choosing either preponderance of the evidence, which means more likely than not, or clear and convincing, which is a higher standard. So there was some speculation that the new regulations would require clear and convincing, but here they're letting schools choose. But one thing the regulations do say is that while the school can choose either burden of proof, their burden of proof that they use has to be the same for Title IX complaints against students and against employees. So if some schools have collective bargaining agreements with employees using the clear and convincing standard, then they would either have to use the clear and convincing standard for students also, or they'd have to change that collective bargaining agreement to preponderance of the evidence. Most schools currently use preponderance of the evidence, and I expect almost all schools to continue using preponderance of the evidence.
Now, how quickly must higher education institutions comply with these new regulations? There's obviously a lot there. And what potential legal litigation holds may delay the enforcement of this? Because, you know, obviously this has been a very contentious set of changes.
These are certainly very contentious. Right now, the enforcement date is August 14th. So that gives not a lot of time, about 3 months in order to change policies and train staff. So that's a lot to do in 3 months, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic and all the difficulties that pose. There already are people talking about filing litigation to try to halt the regulations. We don't know yet if those will be successful, if there'll be stays of enforcement. There's also a presidential election coming up where Joe Biden said he would repeal the regulations if he's elected. Of course, if he does win and he's sworn in, that would be after the effective date of these regulations. So there are complications and unknowns here, but right now schools need to be prepared to adopt these policies by August 14th.
Now, finally, whatever happens, there's going to be a need for a lot of training to be done. When do universities need to start doing that training, and what should they be emphasizing when they're trying to change staff and students?
Training is going to be essential here. First of all, they have to understand the new definitions so they can apply them correctly. That is probably the easier part of the training. What's going to be more complicated, I believe, is actually conducting the investigations with all the procedural steps, including discovery, including making sure that people get proper written notice, making sure the right advisors are in place. So training staff so that they understand what's required and that they can effectively apply these to investigations. And then maybe even more challenging is the live hearings, because you're asking schools now to sort of be quasi courtrooms where witnesses will testify. Someone up, either a panel or a hearing officer, will have to decide what questions are admissible, what questions are not admissible, what evidence is allowed, what's not allowed. And as a former prosecutor, I could tell you there are many sitting judges who have problems with those issues and challenges in deciding what's admissible, what's not. And to ask a school that's not experienced in a courtroom setting in enforcing the rules of evidence for an adversarial hearing, to ask a school official to do that, that's a lot to learn. So schools are either going to have to staff up internally with experienced people or hire outside experts to advise them or to conduct the hearings. And that's all being done at a time where school budgets are more restrained than ever because of the coronavirus crisis. So this poses a lot of challenges, but certainly you have to have trained people do this, because if untrained people are leading investigations and overseeing hearings, there will be a lot of problems that will lead to more litigation and bad results.
Yeah, that's certainly what you don't want to have in cases as sensitive as these. So it looks like there's going to be a lot of struggle ahead for compliance team as they try and ensure that their organizations comply with the new rules for Title IX. Well, Dan, thank you for giving us these insights into this issue. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to listen. I'm Adam Turteltaub from SCCE and HCCA. I hope we're able to expand your compliance perspective.